Welcome to the Brute Strength Podcast, bringing you worldwide experts from all areas of health and fitness. We cover training, nutrition, coaching, and mindset. Welcome your host, strength and conditioning coach, 2012 and 2013 CrossFit Games champ, Michael Cashew. Mind, body, brute.
Hey, and welcome back. This is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. This week, I've got two of my best friends on the show, Pat and Taz Barber. Today, we're talking about the launch of a new program that we're doing together called Outside the Box. It is a collaboration between Brute Strength and their company, Warm Up and Workout, or WUO. And this program is designed for people that want to maintain a high level of fitness, but don't have access to a box that they trust or to good programming. This is for people that want to be as efficient as possible with their time while following a program from experts that they can really trust. At Brute Strength, we have always prided ourselves in finding the best of the best in every area of fitness and the sport of fitness. And so when we were thinking about creating a program like this, we knew that we had to find someone that fit that bill. And no one in the CrossFit industry understands this type of programming like Pat and Taz. So in this show, we talk about their own personal transformation in fitness. I actually coached both of them in 2014, when they were at NorCal. And I coached them at the games. And so I saw them compete at a very high level. And then over the next couple of years, I saw them transition out of being very high level competitive athletes. And we talk about what it was like for them transitioning from competing at an elite level and having all of the motivation in the world to maintain training and to work out for hours and hours a day. And then what it was like for them going into not competing anymore, which I know a lot of people, that really resonates with a lot of people, including myself. We talk about how, like what happens when your priorities change, how you can continue to make fitness a priority. We talk about finding your why in training, and we talk about all of the details in this program. Again, these are two of my favorite people. We actually also talk about parenting because these guys are epic parents. We talk about some different parenting strategies and lessons that they've learned towards the end. So anyway, I know you guys are going to love this show. These guys are raw, they're authentic, and they're two of my favorite people. So without further ado, Pat and Taz Barber. Pat and Taz, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us, Mike.
Hi.
Very excited to have two of my favorite people on the show at the same time.
This is
my third interview with you, Pat, but I finally get the brains behind the operation on the Brute Strength Podcast. It's nice to have you here, Taz. Let's talk about your knife making for a little bit. A couple things have happened recently that have me more like personally interested in what you're up to. The first is I listened to the episode, the Tim Ferriss episode with Mr. Money Mustache. Fascinating episode. And he is very into doing things with his hands. And he talks a lot about the value that that brings to life. And the second is I read a book called Digital Minimalism. And in this book, the author, Cal Newport, talks about what's the term he uses? Something like some sort of valuable activity. And he talks about doing physical things with your hands and seeing yourself create something with your hands being so much more valuable than even, say, creating something out of code or doing like the vast majority of work activities. Because when we're working, we can't really see the effect that we're having. We can't see what we're producing. And so he says that we have sort of evolved to value creating things with our hands more. So I just want to hear from your perspective, what's been the experience of knife making? Like why did you get into it in the first place? And what's been the effects for you in your life?
I mean, I think everything that you just said there rings true for me. I mean, I was, as you know, I was never really much into building and crafting and all that stuff. I always found art really hard. I'm not particularly detailed when it comes to fine motor skills and things that are aesthetically pleasing to other people than myself. So I've always loved the process of like sitting and, you know, molding clay, but it always came out like, oh, what's that supposed to be? It's an ashtray. Leave me alone. You know? my initial foray into this was building our little mini unit in the back of our house with my dad. And that was like getting into building stuff. You know, I always liked how things fit together. And as a kid, I was the kid who would take apart a, you know, toaster or something like that, but I could never put it back together. I had no idea what I was doing, but I liked the process of working with my hands. And only once I like had the kids and bought the house and it was like up to me to make this stuff work, did I really start to see the value, or did I feel the value and the response of building something and looking at it when you're done. Mm-hmm. And it started with the little mini house, and it was exactly as you're describing. There's like when we finished, like it was such hard work. And when we finished and looked at it, I was like, I built that. We built that. Like, that's a real thing. That is awesome. And though there was, you know, there's tons of imperfections and it was super ghetto, it just kind of gave me the mental freedom to try it again. Mm-hmm. And know that I had like a base level of skill. And then that led me down all these different avenues of building a fence by myself and setting the posts and going on YouTube and figuring out how it's done. And you realize that all this stuff is super basic on like the entry level of it is like you learn a couple things. You learn how to measure. You learn how to measure again. You learn how to cut. You learn how to cut incorrectly. You learn how to hammer. You learn how to screw. And like then that's it. Like that's it. And then once you know how to do that stuff, you can build anything. And the knife making was just kind of a process into, I got into pocket knives and I wanted to buy some, but you can't really justify owning more than one pocket knife. And I couldn't at the time convince my wife to let me buy pocket knives and many, let alone many of them. But if I wrapped it in some sort of craft, like, you know, forging, which I never had any intention of doing, I could then like start to invest a little bit of money here and you know, potentially have a hobby that was offered that same kind of gratification. And it's been like I stumbled across this world, and after picking up a Farrier's Forge on Craigslist, you know, dove in head first, and it's been fantastic. Just like you're saying, every time I finish one, I look at it and I'm like, this is hours worth of work. And
he runs around the house waving it around saying, yeah. I made this.
The knife that I'm running around the house waving it around. But the
one of the many things.
And,
yeah.
I'm naked while I do it. It's just fantastic. And what's really cool for me is watching the progress. I mean, you can even go to the knife that I gave you. Like I gave you one of my very first knives that I was remotely proud of. Like the other ones were, what was that?
That's a real piece of shit.
It is. I mean, to compared to what I've made since then,
right.
It is a real piece of shit. Like it, and that's the fascinating thing to me. It's been what, 5 months, 4 months?
Right.
And I've only made 8 knives in between then, but the leaps and bounds in progress have been so fun for me, like so emotionally satisfying to sit and look at it and be like, awesome, I'm done with it, move on, try it again. Anyway, that's been my process through it.
Super cool, man. It's so inspiring to watch. In the book, he talks also about how the art of like apprenticeship is more or less dead, how we don't have long-term mentors teaching crafts anymore. So one thing that jumped out at me as you were starting to tell the story about building the house behind your house was that you did it with your dad. So I'm kind of considering doing the same thing at our house, and I'm trying to decide, do I just do the entire thing by myself from scratch? Do I do it with the help of a contractor? What was the benefit of having your dad around, and like how much do you recommend having someone there for you to support you when you're learning this type of stuff?
I mean, Taz can tell you, but honestly, I couldn't recommend it more with the first couple projects, because there's so many roadblocks where you're looking at something and being like, I have no idea. And like, hey, if I wire this wrong, does this whole thing explode? Like, and you're so in the dark as to what's going on that having someone there kind of hold your hand through the first big project and all the little stumbling blocks that, you know, in my history of trying to build would just, I'd look at it and be like, that's good enough and move on.
Right.
Or something where I'd look at it and be like, I don't know what to do. And then just stop working. Mm-hmm. They help you through that. And I think, and that gives you the confidence to then try to figure stuff out on your own. So I think with the first big project, no matter what it is, if you can get a mentor, they just show you the basics and they allow you to get through sticking points that much easier.
Taz, what have you, like, since he's really dove into this, this whole realm of his life, what have you noticed in, I don't know, his overall sense of well-being or happiness and anything else that you've noticed?
Yeah. I mean, Pat always has something. So before the knives, and surfing is still a thing, but before the knives, it was surfing and surfboards. And then before that, it was something, you know, we have like every sporting equipment under the sun in our house. Like when Pat gets interested in something, he goes full head on in it. So what I've noticed over the years is he has to have some sort of hobby. Like if he doesn't do it, we go like 2 or 3 days without him having that outlet to, you know, bang metal or be outside grinding or going for a surf. Like it really affects his mental capacity. Like he doesn't function how he, you know, he doesn't thrive.
Right.
And I'm a little different. Like I can go days without kind of doing my own hobbies or my projects and I'm fine, but it's different with Pat. He really, really needs it to be happy and stable. And I need Pat to be happy because when Pat's happy, I'm happy.
Happy husband, happy life.
Yeah. I mean, that's the saying. That's how it goes, right?
Right, exactly.
He kind of holds the family up with his like jolliness, you know. So it's yes. Like if he's not jolly, then it's a little down around here.
Gotcha.
I think jolly carries a weight connotation, and I resent that remark. Thank you very much.
A what connotation?
A weight, like I think a certain level of plumpness.
I think you're projecting
to be jolly. I think she's talking about my body shape at the moment. Oh. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Insecure.
He's awfully plump around here.
I mean, it's why he's so jolly.
So you told me before the show that you're working on disconnecting from your phone more.
Dude, that's hard. Like it's interesting for me because I know that I don't have much time with my kids. And what I mean by that is not like in a day, like we have fantastic lives to where we can spend a lot of time with our kids and we're so fortunate for that. But just in life, like Taz made a post the other day that I read it and it said, you know, it's a picture of my son Oaks and it's like, we've got 11 more years with this guy. And I'm like, wait, what? 11 more years? It's already like we've already almost hit 11 and we've only got 11 left. We're like close to being halfway through this kid leaving the house. It's not right. Like he then disappears, but it's this that just slapped me right in the face. So like the time goes by so quick as a parent. So I don't like being on my phone, but they're so primed to be used. They're made to be addictive. They're made to prey on that center of your brain. And I, dare I say it, I don't think I'm strong enough right now. And then the double edged sword of this is like our businesses are all online.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think that's why we justify it sometimes to ourselves is because we do run we run our businesses online. So we'll just grab our phone and almost be like, well, we don't say it in our head, like this is for business, but we're trying to stay on top of things.
Totally.
And so if we aren't, you know, if we don't respond fast enough or quick enough to Facebook messages or Instagram messages, you know, that's our business.
Yeah. And so there's this like double whammy of like, I want to be away from it, but I have to be connected to it. But I only want to be connected to it when I have to be connected to it, which then leads me to just do it randomly. And then there's, you know, have you read the Why We Sleep book yet? Oh, it's fantastic. You'll love it. I mean, the gist of it is we really need to sleep as human beings. But there's, oh yeah. It's deep on all the little studies it goes into, but it talks about the ability that sleep has on, basically your ability to regulate emotions, both positive and negative. And when you are not regulating, like when you're tired and you're not regulating positive emotions, then you just seek pleasure like really often. And we're in a state of like perpetual tiredness when you have a third child and two other ones and launching businesses and doing all this stuff. So that, like, then the barrier, that threshold is just lowered. So these things that stimulate pleasure in my brain are just like, just do it. It's fine. We'll just log on for a second. And so,
I think that's what I was saying to you before, Mike, about like when we do get a few minutes in the day, because we're so tired, like we can't regroup and be like, well, maybe this is a good time to do, you know, X, like put the washing on or something. So yeah, I think like what Pat just said, it's like our brains go to the easiest thing to, you know, waste a bit of time.
Right.
And so I guess to go to your original question was like, what are you trying to do? Is like, we're trying to be on our phones less, but there's a reality of where we're at in life right now. And
Pat made a box. This is actually like the third box.
I made a drawer.
But he's made a box before.
I've made a box before that has a little lock key on it that I can put my phone in. And then I also took a drawer and drilled a hole in the back of the drawer and then put a section on it to where a charger plugs into it. So the phone is like out of sight, out of mind. So it plugs into that back hole on the drawer. So like you have to pull the drawer all the way out, grab the phone to use it. So it just kind of sits in a deep, dark cavern.
I also think it's quite habitual because when we go away, like when we go on our trips and even just this weekend, we just went to Pat's dad's house just for a night. I left my phone down in the bedroom that whole time we were at Pat's dad's house. Mm-hmm. I only would look at it just briefly to make sure there was nothing like serious with the Airbnb or, you know, whatever. And that's it. But I think at home, because we're so in our like work mode, life mode, when we're at home, that's what makes that like habit just continuous. Like, oh, just tap it to see if something's there or, you know, I think it's like a bad habit, obviously.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's something that I'm constantly experimenting with. I'm currently back on social media, but I think after we're done, we're journaling about our keto experiment every day right now. I think after I'm done, I don't really know what I'm going to do because I'm stuck in the, yeah, but I need this for work mode. And also I really, really dislike social media and the effect that it has on me personally. So Digital Minimalism, the book that I talked about in the very beginning, it talks all about this. I think you guys would really dig it. So I think I'm going to do a detox, digital detox, and like at the end of this experiment, and just very intentionally bring technology, bring the phone back into my life and kind of set some more rigid boundaries around how I use it. I really like the box idea. I'm sorry that it didn't work for you. And now you're into a drawer.
Now we have a hole in a drawer.
Yes.
Hole in a drawer.
You know what, though? Twice now, the kids have put the phones in the drawer.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
Yeah, I think so. And it's Oakes is becoming more aware of it. He's like, what did he say the other day? When I picked up my phone, he said, Mom, it's going to kill your brain.
Yeah, scrambles your brain.
Yeah.
That's what he said.
That is true, in a way.
Yeah, it's true.
Fragments your attention, so you can't focus as much. So it's kind of scrambling your brain.
Yeah.
So, guys, go ahead.
Before I go into that, I was just thinking, like, I was reflecting on social media, and take Instagram, for instance. I think Instagram has almost no value other than business. Like, the only thing that Instagram really gives anybody is a business platform. Like, think about a personalized Instagram account. Like, the stuff you're posting, is it because you want people to see it, or is it because you want to remember it? Because if you've taken that photo, it's already in your phone.
But I think it's connecting. Like, okay,
it connecting?
Well, take away strangers. So for me, I have family around the world, right? I have my parents, my brothers. They live New Zealand, Ireland, and then I have lots of family in South Africa. So in one way, it's an opportunity for them to see our lives. I mean, I'm not saying that's necessarily thing, but it is one way for them to kind of connect with us still.
I get it. I guess you're right.
He draws this distinction in the book between connection and conversation. It definitely can connect us in like a shallow sense to people,
right?
But it actually keeps us from having more in-depth conversation and deeper connection with people because we tell ourselves that we're already getting that through social media.
Right.
So I think it's kind of it's a false sense of connection that we that we see, right? And we also then maintain the fringe of our relationships, like our not so close relationships, often at the expense of our very close, deep relationships, because then we have less time for them.
Totally.
Yeah, good point.
I agree.
So we're launching a new program together today.
Yep.
It's called Outside the Box. We've been working on this for a long time, and we are excited about it.
It has been a while launching this.
Let's talk about how this whole thing came about. So you guys both competed in CrossFit at a very high level. I was actually your CrossFit coach at one point.
That's how we met.
That is how we met.
Mm-hmm.
And I would program these really long rows, and everyone would do them except for Pat.
Hey! I did those.
That's true. That's true. a couple of you, two of the six, maybe.
Yeah.
So, first off, before we get into the birth of this program, what changed for you guys when you stopped competing?
Do you want to answer for you, and I'll answer for me?
Sure. Yeah.
Well, why don't we go Pat answers for Taz and Taz for...
That'd be interesting.
Fair enough. Do you want to go first?
Well, mine kind of coincided with having babies. So our first child, Oaks, wasn't planned. So we got pregnant the year we got engaged, and we also moved to back to Santa Cruz all in 1 year and started the new gym with Jason at in San Jose. So a lot was happening that year. And then I got pregnant with Oaks. And so I had Oaks, and I was actually struggling with a bit of a hip injury at the time. So my transition from competing to not competing was kind of a forced one through having a child. And then somehow I got kind of convinced to be back on the team, which is when I met you. But I knew that that was temporary for me, because it was really hard to do both well, train full time and be a parent full time. Mm-hmm. And I remember we were on the airplane coming back from the games that year when you coached us, and Oaks was really sick. And so he'd been, we went to Disneyland after the games, and it was all fun. We got some family time in, but that whole like couple of months leading up to it and the week at the games, Pat's mom was there with us, and she helped out a lot. So she took a lot of, you know, the child caring for us at that time. And then when we're on the plane coming home, he was so sick, and he, instead of wanting me to hold him, he asked for Nana. He was like, no, I want Nana. And like, I will never forget that moment. It just cut me so deep. And he wanted her because, you know, she had been there for him for that whole time, and I hadn't. And I don't think that was just me personally. I don't think that was a defining moment. Like, he never wanted me again, mm-hmm. but it was kind of the guilt that I was feeling at the time. And I think for me, that kind of made up my mind. Like, I don't want to have to put as much time into training as I did again that for then.
Yeah. I think especially with young kids, like you need to spend that time with them. Those are the formative years, and they're very, very short. So if you're not with them all the time and you're prioritizing, you know, hours and hours in the gym to be at the competitive level that we were at, like it needed, I mean, you programmed it. It was an hour long row.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're sitting on a rower for
an
hour.
That was one of like 4 hours a day.
Exactly. And yeah. Like, that's just, it's incredibly selfish, but for a purpose, you know, it's for a goal. It's just, I think for Taz, it was not.
Yeah, it wasn't for me. And I'm not saying that, you know, other mothers out there, like they can do it and good for them. Like I just, for me, it was just, I was just really torn. I just made that decision that it wasn't. And also because I had that hip thing and coming back was really hard for me. And I wasn't anywhere near the level of athleticism that the other two girls were. Like I held my own at that games, and luckily there were like things that were in my wheelhouse, like swimming and running. So that was great. But, you know, my strength and all those things that take a long time to kind of get back, I never quite got back to that point. And I don't think I wasn't willing to put the work in, I guess.
I love how, I don't know if you remember that year, but Taz, like, I held my own. Taz was hands down the MVP of that team. She pulled the entire boat by herself, did all the runs. Like, come on.
She was a beast for sure. So what changed for you after you stopped? Like, what was your experience like after?
like physically, emotionally, or all of it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like what? How was your, for instance, how was your motivation to continue training? What was it like for you identifying as an athlete?
Yeah, I think I've been an athlete my whole life, so I've always had a very good self-motivating drive to be fit or be involved in a sport of some sort. So that transition, like I think I lost a bit of my identity, like being the CrossFit athlete to no longer being a CrossFit athlete. And I did definitely feel, you know, like a little sad when I would see like the CrossFit games and I wasn't competing, or Pat would go off and do regionals and I wasn't in the team, or, you know, so I got a bit of FOMO there. But I think when you have kids, like your identity shifts so quickly to being a parent that I wasn't that sad about it. It wasn't like this huge loss. I wasn't like mourning the loss of being an athlete. Mm-hmm. And for me, like I said, like I'm quite self-motivated. So just like being a regular CrossFitter, just training 4 or 5 times a week wasn't a hard transition for me at all. Yeah.
I think that's awfully rare, but I definitely have seen that in you. You just seem, you seem to just gracefully transition into that new area of your life. Whereas I think the vast majority of people, me included, have a really hard time, dissociating from that identity of being an athlete. So kudos to you. I wish it was that easy, when I had my back surgery and I was done, but, it was not. It was challenging for sure. Pat, how about you, man?
Yeah, different world for me. I obviously didn't transition the same way she did. I mean, she had the kid, so that's one thing. And then I was still competing for a couple years after that. And I was selfish for those first few years of my son's life, and, you know, did go off and do the 4 hours of training and continue to do that. And for me, like I have a pretty strong sense of self. I've always had that due to kind of how I was raised, and you and I have talked about that before. But for me, it was more like my training identity disappeared, right? So like I stopped competing, and then I looked at my reasons for training, and it was non-existent. It was like, why would I go sit in the gym and suffer? Like, you know, like it there was just no meaning there for me. So what I had to do was, over the last, you know, few years, has been really try to find out why to train. And you and I have done some stuff together, and, you know, like I've had a tore my rotator cuff, separated my AC joint, got a neuroma in my foot, and also had 2 kids. And it's like the post competition era of my life has been kind of trying to find the things to make me happy, not necessarily give me identity. Cause like I have like I said, a relatively strong sense of identity. So I didn't struggle with the same thing I think you struggled with when you hurt your back, of like, this is my identity as a competitor. It was more just like, I struggled with like, why am I in the gym other than to help other people? Like that was always there. Like, I want to be helping other people. I want to be training other people. I want to be coaching people. Like, I'm good at this. I get validation here. But when it comes to my own self, it was hard, you know. And I did the surfing and I do the building and I do all that other stuff. But a reason to be fit, I mean, and continue training that's what I lost. Mm-hmm. And that's been the journey for me up until recently.
And what happened recently?
Well, funny you should ask. Recently I actually did, we just tried to figure out a schedule, basically a schedule and a good set of reasons as to why to train. So Taz and I like talked about scheduling, and I hate having a schedule and I hate being like confined to something. But when I was given a really strict schedule and scheduled in free time in my life, hey, here's free time. Here's the time that we're with the kids. Here's the time we're with family. Here's work time. Here's all this. Like it freed up so much psychologically. It was so different than having like a vague schedule of like, in this general time, you should do this.
Yeah. I would just like write like, okay, so here, like you can work or you can do spare time. And he's like, no, well, which one is it? I'm like, well, you decide. Like for me, I'm like, aren't you adult enough to decide when you're going to work and when you're going to have free time? He's like, no, I'm not.
Clearly no. So the schedule was one thing. And then I put out there publicly, like, I've been struggling with a why. I'm struggling with a reason to train. And I got so many amazing responses from people. Like, I don't know if you saw that post, but like, I had a solid 50 people write some awesome stuff. People from like Mike Bergner to like just random people. And they were all totally different. And I think what has really helped me is these days when I go to the gym or when I'm in my garage, like, I look at myself and I'm like, I don't really want to train right now. Well, let's try to find a why that makes sense. You know, people always talk about this really driving force, this, and I've always had one, which was be better than everybody else. And I don't care about that anymore.
Right.
So now it's like, I go in there and I can just look through this list and find one that resonates with me for the day. It's like, today, my why, it could be as simple as like, because it's on the schedule. Or it could be as complex as like, I want to be a good role model for my kids and they're in here playing with me right now. And this is the third day in a row that I've trained, you know, and having those different reasons and having just a straight up list has been monumental for my own psychology. And so that, and also realizing that I don't need the same type of push that I used to. Like, I was so wrapped up in being the best that my training was hard. Like, if I'm training next to somebody else that I have the potential of beating, even if I shouldn't necessarily appropriately beat them, I'm going to go as hard as I can to beat them. It's just the way my psychology works. And I won't do that like at the expense of my physicality. I'm not going to hurt myself, but I'm going to go really, really hard. And to gear up psychologically for that every day, if you don't have a large why, is really hard. So recently having those whys and also having programming that I feel comfortable going, like knowing that I'm doing it to stay fit and not doing it to beat the crap out of other people. It means that if I'm not feeling it for the day, it's a low enough threshold to where I can just go through the motions. It's not like I can't go through the motions on a 5x5 back squat at 80%. You know, like, I can't go through the motions. I have to psychologically gear up for that and attack it. But if I go in there and it's like, you know, here's this little 21-15-9 with a dumbbell snatches, box jumps, and some suitcase deadlifts, like, I can move through that slowly and it's not going to crush my soul. Or if I'm feeling it that day, I can push and get a really good workout. So scheduling it, finding a list of whys, and knowing that these workouts are there to make my life better and they're at a low enough threshold to where I have the option of, you know, pushing really hard and getting a lot as far as adaptation goes, or just psychologically making it through, has been amazing for my training. Like, we've been really consistent for like 2 months almost.
Three months? Yeah.
Like 3 months, which has been awesome.
That's amazing, and, dude.
Yeah, man. And it's fantastic because, I mean, one of the big drivers for me was the community side of things. And I lost my community when I left NorCal. I didn't have a reason. I didn't have a home anymore.
Right.
So now I was like bouncing around to these other gyms and I didn't feel particularly connected. And so that was another thing that made it so hard. So we go to the gym, to a local gym, CrossFit Up now, once to twice a week, because that's what we're able to make it in with three kids, the businesses, all that stuff. And it's fantastic. I love going in there. Like, I absolutely love it. And then in the other days, we just train in our garage and in our little 30-minute sections.
Yeah, I've never used the – like, I'm a huge, huge proponent of understanding the purpose behind what you're doing and understanding your quote-unquote why for what you're – any discipline that you have in terms of, like, goal accomplishment. But I've never personally used that for my fitness. But it makes so much sense why that works. So for anyone listening, obviously you can try – Pat's idea of crowdsourcing a why from Instagram or social media. But if you don't want to take that step, yeah, I really encourage you guys to spend some time writing about why it's important to you to stay fit and be consistent in the first place. That's super cool, man.
Thanks, man.
So tell us about the out of the box programming. How did that all come about and how does that tie into what we're saying?
So, you know, Taz and I run warm up and workout, and for us that it, like the best thing that someone can do for their health and fitness and just overall longevity is find a good box, a good gym, like good coaches and a good community. Like they transcend almost any training methodology. If you find a group of people that you can commit to, like you're going to make so many more positive changes in your life. If they're chasing, you know, improvement. And that's essentially what the good gyms are. And then you've got a group of people all trying to achieve being better, whether it be in nutrition or sleep or lifestyles or fitness. And I think that good gyms are just the number one elicitors of like lifestyle change and sticking to it than anything else. And that's what we've tried to do with Warm Up and Workout is create spaces for coaches that they can deliver on that promise day in and day out. And so we have been doing that for a long time, and we never really wanted to get into the individual market because we think we can help people through these affiliates. And then we kind of were looking at the space and just seeing how many people didn't have access to a good space like that. They didn't have either the financial means or the locational means or the current motivation to step into a space like that. And we're like, there's people who need this help. And we really think that we have a pretty firm understanding of this general space because
we're now in it.
Because we're exactly that. We're right. Now in that. Like we before we weren't the people who couldn't make it to the gym or who couldn't live this lifestyle or who were
like,
so busy.
Lived like, at the gym, you know?
We lived right. at the gym. Yeah. So it didn't make sense for us to be in that space, but now we're not. Yeah. So basically now, I mean, it's appropriate for us to step into this space because we are this person. We are this not hypothetical. It's real. Like we don't have the time to make it to the gym that we want to make it to. And so this ability to step into the gym, our little home thing, get a workout and get out within 30 minutes is essential to us continuing to stay, to stay fit. I've always been against 30-minute programs in a facility for the most part, because I think that if you're paying to go to a facility and there's a coach there and there's community that needs to be built, like an hour is pretty essential, unless you're just kind of like tapping some sort of progress along. Mm-hmm. And so like it never really made sense to me to input a 30-minute class into a gym. That was just my personal psychology around it. Other than like a low barrier to entry to actually joining or to getting members into your normal classes. But for a home gym, there's not the community around. There's not a coach who's walking you through everything. Like you don't need too many variants in the warm-ups because it's just you. You just need to get warm and then do the workout. The variation can come in the workout portion of it. And it's more about being efficient with your time than anything else. And that's why we feel like what we're doing is awesome and we're fired up to do it.
So how, like, give me a little bit of, detail about what the workouts look like.
You want to, or you want?
You're good. You can.
You sure?
I've been doing them.
I have. We have been doing them a lot. Generally, the way it works is there's about 10 minutes of warming up, and the warm-ups are there's only going to be a variation of 30 warm-ups because
only
30. Yeah. Yes. 30, only 30. But the thing is once people have been on it for a couple months, they'll start to figure out those patterns. They won't have to pay as close attention to those warm-ups. And they can just kind of get in there and get warm. But we wanted to offer some variation so we can make sure whatever workouts are there, people are warmed up for. And then the workouts are anywhere from the rest of that time, that 20 minutes, to more often than not, right around 10, 15 minutes, and sometimes even shorter. And they generally are super minimalist in gear. The lower tier of gear that we have is a dumbbells and a jump rope. That's what we call minimalist. And then we have our mid-range tier, which is dumbbells, jump rope, box, and a medicine ball clean.
Medicine ball clean.
Medicine ball clean. Medicine ball, not the actual movement of a clean. And then the enthusiast, as we like to call it, which is the kitted out version, has a pull up bar, rings. What else? Rower.
Barbell.
Barbell.
And a kettlebell.
Barbell and a kettlebell. Yeah. So it just kind of like bumps it all up. But any of these workouts can be done using those sets of gear and can be scaled accordingly. The only thing that you won't see is true strength days. You won't see on this basically like a 5x5 back squat unless we build this in as an add-on later. So the only thing that you won't really see is like heavy days, like a true heavy day where it's just like 5x5 back squat, get after it. Or you won't see like a classic heavy day than a Metcon that you tend to see at a lot of these facilities just because in a 30-minute period, you don't really have the opportunity to truly go heavy. Like if you're going to take a heavy day seriously, you need to go heavy. Mm-hmm. And you need to allot enough time for that. It's just the only way that it's truly possible. And we might have add-ons down the road where if people want to add that in there, they can, but they're still going to get strength work through, you know, heavier EMOMs that we'll do or things that have heavier loading in the actual workouts. It just won't be a true heavy day by any means.
Right. And I mean, which is completely fine if your goal is to be fit for life, to be able to play with your kids or to be able to participate in a sport that you love or just to be able to live to 150 years old. Once your goal is no longer to compete in powerlifting or CrossFit or just to have the heaviest back squat you can, things like that matter a little bit less.
They do. And I still believe that like, if you truly wanted to maximize your fitness, you would find a space and get under a heavy barbell. I mean, the physiological adaptations that can elicit is kind of not possible any other way, mm-hmm. you know? And those things are amazing. But at the same time, that's not this program. If you want that, go find a great coach, go get into a great space and get after that. Mm-hmm. If you're truly looking to maximize that, this is more a supplement to life. And that's kind of how I've viewed it in my head is this supplements living a good life. For a long time, our whole lives were about fitness and we used fitness for like, our lives were fitness. And now we want fitness to supplement our life. Our lives aren't about that anymore. And that's what this is now. Will I truly be like Rich Froning by doing this program? Hell no. Like that's not what it's for. It's for being better, healthier, and improving my general level of fitness.
Yeah, you're way too hairy to be Rich Froning.
I was gonna say,
you guys are dicks.
Where can people find out more about this program?
OutsideTheBox.fit.
Love it.
Yeah, we got that .fit domain.
We only had to pay $250,000, but we got it.
There's also outsidethebox.fit on Instagram. You can also see it through the Brute. We're going through all the Brute channels, so you can see it in the emails there. And if you sign up in this first month, before the first of the month, on the first day of launch, which is going to be the 18th, then you get 30 days free. So you get the first month free, I should say.
Love
and
it.
It's going to be awesome.
So guys, let's close out with some parent talk, because you guys are absolutely epic parents, even if you can't keep your baby quiet on a podcast.
Ken suggested we just put him in a room upstairs.
He'll figure it out. But seriously, I Adi and I have spoken to you guys probably every single time we see you about your philosophy on parenting and different strategies that you have, because you have such a unique style of parenting and your kids are incredible and it's just really admirable. So up to this point, what are you most proud of so far in raising your kids?
Oh, wow. Pat, what do you think?
I personally am really proud of the strength of mine and Taz's relationship. I think that for me, it's pretty easy to have the emotional stress of parenting push a couple apart. Mm-hmm. They do nothing for increasing romance or increasing emotional connectivity through deep, long walks on the beach, because that that shiz don't happen. Like no matter how much you want it to. But I think that what I'm most proud of is that like I've never loved Taz more than I love her now. And I've never felt closer to her, even though we'll go like, you know, a week or two without really sitting down and having not a week or two. We'll go a few days without really being able to connect emotionally, you know? And so I think for me in our parenting that's something that I'm the most proud of. That doesn't really answer your question as far as with the kids though.
Well, I think it does, because I truly believe that one of the best things you can do for your kids is have a rock solid relationship so that they feel secure. And that is so unique. Like that's so rare that that's something that you said, because what you most often hear, especially with young kids, is it's like the biggest obstacle in the way of relationships. So what are you guys doing that is so different from other relationships? Like how are you maintaining such a strong relationship?
I think we don't really know, but we talk about it. We just have this like unspoken kind of like very deep connection, and we discussed this the other day, and I think we came to the conclusion that we don't actually need each other, which sounds really kind of harsh, but I think it's on the flip side, it's sort of like what makes us so connected is because we are just so content within ourselves that we can be in these moments of stress and the moments of chaos and not feel like I need you to do this. And just, we don't have to like lean on each other for emotional support. I mean, we do in our own way, but it's not through like desperation. I think it's just through husband and wife stuff.
When she says don't need each other, she means don't need each other's emotional support to feel whole. Like we're confident people without the spouse. Like we both discussed where if we didn't have the other person, we would be crappy. Like,
yeah,
I would hate not having her, and life would be way worse without her. So I do need her.
Way worse than it already like, is.
I do need her. It's just that I don't need anything from her, so to speak. Like she doesn't need to be a certain way or do a certain thing in order for me to feel the love for her. And I'm the same way. Like I mean, she's the same way.
We're not needy.
Yeah. We're not needy as far from each other. I also think that there's a certain level of transparency in our relationship, and trust. Like if I'm going to do something, I'm going to tell her. I'm not going to not tell her and hope she doesn't find out. And that requires trust, because I do some dumb stuff. So it's like, I'll have to be like, so I bought a jet ski, you know, like,
or a forge,
or like I spent all our money here. And then she feels confident to be like, hey, that was a really bad decision. You need to return the jet ski. So like, there's this mutual respect and a line of like, transparency. There's no layers to there's not a layer to our relationship that's like this unspoken, well, if you don't do the dishes, I'm going to poop on the toilet seat. Like I don't know. That doesn't exist for me, at least. Maybe it exists for Taz and she just hides it all the time. And I'm living in ignorant bliss over here.
Right. I don't know why you talk crap on the jet ski. That's about the best investment one can make. No, that's awesome. I love the way of looking, or the perspective of looking at relationships, where like a codependent relationship is where two people make each other whole. And you guys kind of touched on this, where you're filling a hole in someone basically. And a co-committed relationship is one where each person takes care of themselves as individuals, and then you come together as two complete and whole individuals, so that you're not coming into the relationship as a super needy person and just taking from the other person's already half empty cup.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So as parents, what do you guys still struggle with? What is an or multiple obstacles that you're still dealing with?
Everything. Everything every day.
Man, it really is a struggle every day. Like, you go through days where you think you're, because we read a lot. I read a lot about parenting. Mm-hmm. And whenever you read these parenting books, you're like, oh, that makes so much sense. Yeah, I'm going to try that. Yes. Like, yeah, the child's the whole brain child. Like, it's, you know, all this stuff. And you go into talking to them with all this in mind. And then it just, something happens. It's a different situation to it was in the book. And it's not exactly how you read it. And then, like, your tolerance goes down, you're tired. And so things just don't pan out like they did when how you imagined it. So we're struggling every day, but I think going back to your answer about question about like what we do well. I mean, I don't think we do anything specifically well at all. Like, we're just the same as any other parent, but I think we're very lucky that we get to have so much time with our kids. Mm-hmm. So we're around them a lot. So we can be somewhat consistent with them, which allows us to make mistakes, because we can like fix them and try again. We get a lot of opportunities to do that, whereas a lot of parents aren't as lucky and they only get a few hours a day. And they're probably tired. They're probably, things are happening for them. So I think in that sense, we're really lucky that we have this much time, kind of like a trial and error. Like, kids are really like trial and error situation. Yeah.
That's a very interesting way to look at it. You get more repetitions. So that anytime you have more repetitions at something, you're going to be better at it. That's right. Really cool. Yeah.
And so I'm trying to view our parenting is just like, just creating relationships with our kids rather than them just, we're the parents, they're the kids. You know, we're trying to create good relationships with them, so that can transfer over into when they're adults and when they're having relationships with other people. And I think that's helped my mindset too, is trying to create these relationships with the kids.
It doesn't mean always being their friends. I mean, I think there's a very, personally, right. I think there's a really clear distinction between parents and friends. Like, friends don't put boundaries on each other, you know, like
totally.
The parent's role is to set boundaries for kids. And I think that that's where I've seen it slightly go awry, where it's like, I'm going to build a relationship with my kid. You know, it's a two-way street with everything. And personally, I think like, someone needs to put those boundaries in there. And right. Like, that's for me, that's how I view it, is like, I want to be as close to this human being as I can while understanding that their boundaries forever are set in place by my relationship with them. And what I demonstrate with them and what they demonstrate with me. So it's a hard thing, because, you know, as we get more run down and we get sleepier, like our emotions go different places and
you sound like we're dying.
I don't know. No, we're not dying. I'm three young kids. Anyway, I feel like what we're doing well is constantly reevaluating and not getting stuck on any one thing, not picking one solution that always works and just going after that. I think we make a lot of mistakes like every day, and we have to apologize for those to our kids and go in there and say, hey man, I shouldn't have yelled at you for throwing your brother down those stairs. Although, why did you throw your brother down those stairs? Let's talk about the negative ramifications of throwing your brother down the stairs. And then I maybe come full circle and say, you know what? I should have yelled at you. That's a time where yelling is appropriate. Let's learn about this little 6-year-old. Mm-hmm. So I think that like constantly reevaluating where we're at and just being there, like that's what I think we're doing well, but it doesn't mean that anything's easy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think to answer your question about what the hardest job is, yeah, we said everything, but I think specifically for our children is the sibling relationship, because we find that really hard. Like the constant at each other, the constant bickering, the constant stealing of toys, the young one, the big one hurting the young one being a pain in the ass, you know, we're trying to, and then the young one, like the older one is just modeling this terrible behavior. And then the young one does that terrible behavior because he's the, you know, it's just a constant back and forth. But yeah, I think constantly re-evaluating and consistently being present is definitely helping us.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that you're not saying that I'm picking up on is you're just staying very engaged with like, how am I doing as a parent and working on evolving as a parent rather than just putting out fires and trying to get by. Like you're being very engaged in the learning process of being a better parent.
Yeah. I think we, again, we're in a very privileged position to be able to do that.
Right.
Like, I mean, and we don't do that every day, you know, like the days that we're stressed and we're tired and we're trying to get these businesses going and, you know, we probably aren't very good parents. Like right now we're doing this podcast and our kids are watching TV. Like, you know, that's fine. We're okay with that. But, I think because we're so privileged and we have a roof over our heads, we have enough money to eat, we have enough, we have friends and we have a community. We have the time, the mental energy to be able to put towards parenting, mm-hmm. Which, you know, we're really grateful for. And I think that's where a lot of people struggle. They don't have the mental energy. So they're just getting by every day. They're just like putting out fires. Like, are the kids alive? Are they fed? Good. Great. They're doing well, you know? And I think that's a really, really hard thing to overcome for a lot of people.
Right.
I think the thing that I would say is like, if I could offer anything to a parent out there, it'd be like, in every situation, you can look at the situation and be like, what if this is me? And what if this is the situation? Because sometimes like I'll respond to something and realize that my response was wholeheartedly inappropriate. And if I don't re-examine that, then I'm never going to see that. And I'm never going to look at the fact that the reason I responded that way was because for me and my growth, whenever someone treated somebody else that way, it's particularly inflammatory for me. So now I have to be like, okay, that was an inappropriate response to a relatively mild situation. And that's me. That's my fault. And I think a lot of people can benefit from like looking at situations and then look at other situations and be like, no, that is the appropriate response for that. And I'm doing a good job. And I just think that separation, like that constant work on self helps you be a parent so much because you can start to differentiate between your shit and actual shit.
Yes. Taz, so you've now been pregnant 3 times. And you have a lot of experience with Pat and the way he either supports or doesn't support you. What are the behaviors that he has that have you feel most supported when you're pregnant?
He's really supportive. What was that face you just did? he supports me in any way I need. Like and I don't want to like make the sound like I'm like tooting my husband's horn, but since we had Oaks, he has grown like so much as a human. You know, he was, how old were you when I was pregnant with Oaks?
20.
So he was 27, 26 when we had Oaks. And he wasn't that supportive. He didn't understand what it meant to go through a pregnancy. He didn't understand what it meant to have a baby. And like he said before, like he was quite selfish with the time that he gave. You know, he still needed his alone time and his personal time. And but since we've had Arrow, and even more so with Forks, anything that I've needed, like if I need time, if I need them to leave the house, if like I can just ask Pat and he will give it to me. He's not great at sensing things. Like I can't give him a cue and he'll be like, oh, Taz needs me to get out of the house. I have to tell him and I have to ask. And that's hard for me because I'm not used to asking for things. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of helped me grow as a human as well by just asking when I need help. I mean, like, right. I need you to do this. I need to have a bit of time today to do some extra work. Can you do this? I need to eat a bowl of ice cream. Can you go get it for me? And he usually eats like 3 bowls himself as well as me eating a bowl. So he's very helpful in that way.
Hypothetically.
Yeah. just hypothetically, it's never happened.
Right.
Yeah. So as a husband, I think just kind of, there was one, and I think we actually talked to you about when we were there with you guys, there was one moment where, we had a disagreement and I had to put my foot down. I'm like, you don't get to have a say in this right now. I'm the one who's pregnant and, you need to be okay with that. And he was like, okay, all right. And he just backed down and nice. I was like, well, that was cool. I didn't think that would happen, you know, and it might not happen like moving forward, but he was very respectful, like, because I brought out the pregnancy card and,
yeah.
So yeah, I'm super lucky.
Oh, that's amazing.
I think Mike was asking selfishly what he could do for the fact that, surprise, Dee's pregnant.
You wish.
And I feel like Mike's
pretty yes, supportive. I do wish.
Yeah, I do think I'm supportive. And I also think I'm going to be massively challenged when we finally start popping out babies. And I ask because I see your relationship and I do admire your ability to stay close and transparent while having two, now three, super young children. So I ask that selfishly. Cool, guys. Great time. Thank you for your time.
Nah, man. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. It was fun.
So guys, we talked about the new program that Brute and WooWo are launching. It is Outside the Box, and you can learn more about it at outsidethebox.fit. Go learn more about it. Where can they find out more about you personally?
You can look at, we have a parenting podcast called The Tribe Life, and you can find that on The Tribe Life on Instagram. And you can also look at thetribelife.family. You can find me at patbarbercf on Instagram.
Taz.barber.
Barber.
I said that for the audience.
So right, good. Right. Baba. Yeah. Baba.
Baba.
Yeah, because then everyone would be like searching B-A-B-A.
Good job. That's hilarious. Awesome, guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike.
Hey, guys. Over the past 5 to 10 years, there's been a huge explosion in the number of options and training programs for the sport of fitness. And because there are so many options, it can be really confusing picking the best one for you. So a couple years ago, I created a guide to specifically to help you pick the right training program to meet your needs and to fit your lifestyle. In this guide, I go over how to avoid the biggest programming mistake that I see people making, 5 costly misconceptions about programming, training methods that work best, 3 mistakes to avoid when choosing a training program, the importance of value and price, and then finally, 4 steps to reaching your potential. And this is a free guide. This is something specifically just to help you find what's best for you. And you can get this by going to brutestrengthtraining.com/PYP. That's brutestrengthtraining.com/PYP.
This episode is finished, but your training journey continues. Head over to brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW and grab your free pack of 32 accessory workouts that you can incorporate into your training and start improving your strength immediately. That's brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW.